From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It was a big week for space exploration and a bit of a roller coaster. First, of course, came the excitement over the first image of a black hole. Then there was Israel's attempt to become the fourth nation to land on the moon. It didn't quite go as planned, but they did get close. And then, after multiple delays, SpaceX completed its first commercial space launch. They put a satellite into orbit and landed all three booster rockets safely back on Earth. Joining me now to explore the significance of these events is Regina Jorgensen. She's director of astronomy at Mariah Mitchell Association on Nantucket. Regina, good to have you back on the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the black hole image, which I know you were really excited about. Everybody was really excited about. But it was really interesting to note that this was considered the first, or at least best, evidence that black holes actually exist. I mean, did we actually doubt that beforehand?
Well, that's a very good question. I wouldn't say many scientists doubted the existence of black holes because we've had so much other evidence that they exist, and they are a natural product of Einstein's theory of general relativity, which so far has been a very, very well-tested theory. So I don't think there were a lot of people who actually doubted that they exist, but because we had not actually seen one, or the almost as close to seeing one as you can, which is what was released last week, that's what made this very, very exciting, because this is pretty much the closest we will ever get to seeing a black hole.
Right. I mean, that was part of the fun with this and the amazement with this, is that how do you see something that even sucks in light, won't even let light out? And in fact, that was echoed at the press conference this week.
We are delighted to be able to report to you today that we have seen what we thought was unseeable.
That's right. So by nature, of course, black holes, you know, are these very, very exotic objects that are extremely, extremely dense. And they're so dense that they have so much gravity that even light or any other kind of electromagnetic radiation cannot escape once it's crossed over this region around the black hole called the event horizon. Now, it turns out that black holes also have another component, which is an accretion disk, which is basically a disk of material that's flowing into the black hole. And during this process, that disk of gas heats up and it becomes very, very hot. And therefore, it actually gives off a lot of radiation, a lot of light. And so we were basically able to see that light. And what was very exciting about this image is that it was almost exactly as astronomers had predicted based upon the mass of that black hole.
It ended up looking a little bit, one person on Twitter thought, like a big orange donut.
Yes, I mean, exactly.
It's kind of this glowing circle around a black center, but actually putting that image, it's not terribly detailed, it doesn't look like to the naked eye, but putting that together apparently took more data than any other experiment in scientific history. It was multiple telescopes spread around the planet putting their data together. And it was really amazing to me that the architect of the algorithm that put all that together, Katie Bowman, is soon to be a professor at Caltech, but she was actually a grad student at MIT when she came up with this algorithm. Such a great story.
That's right. Yeah, that is a really exciting thing to come out of this, I think. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen the images of her when the image first popped up on her screen, you know, and she was very excited, of course.
Yeah, just pure joy and amazement.
Yeah. And, you know, that really gets at the point for a lot of people seeing that image, they might say, well, so what? It looks kind of like this fuzzy ring. But what's really important to keep in mind here is the resolution that they needed to achieve in order to see this. This black hole is 55 million light years away in the center of a different galaxy. And the resolving power needed to actually see that, although that sort of black center area where there's the absence of light, is bigger than our solar system. So it's pretty big, but this is also really, really, really far away. And so the resolving power needed is sort of akin to what you would need if you were going to read the text on a quarter in LA from, you know, Washington, D.C. And that's what they were able to do with this very, very strong network of telescopes that were based all around the Earth. So basically, they turned the entire Earth into one giant telescope in order to get this kind of resolving power.
I'm reminded of the beginning of Star Wars a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. This is really, really far away. Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I mean, now that we've done this once, we've got this virtual Earth-sized telescope, the collaboration and the algorithm set up to be able to use that. What else could it be used for? I'm sure this isn't the end of this, right?
No, not at all. In fact, this same team already has data on another black hole. It has not yet been released, but at the same time that they were looking at M87, this is the one that was released, they were also looking at the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is called Sagittarius A star. You'd think that would be easier because it's a lot closer, but it turns out that our black hole at the center of the Milky Way is actually a lot smaller. So it's about 1,000 times less massive than the M87 black hole. And so because it's so much less massive, it's also smaller, which means you, again, need really, really good resolution. And it also is a little difficult to see because it's at the center of our galaxy. And so we're going to be looking through a whole lot of gas and dust along the line of sight to the center of our galaxy. And that just makes observing a little bit more tricky because you have to find the right wavelength of light to actually penetrate through the gas and dust to be able to see the Sagittarius A star.
Well, Regina Jorgensen, I want to turn our attention to some of the other space exploration events this year. And on Thursday, Israel attempted to become the fourth nation to land on the moon. It didn't go quite. They got so close. Here's what one of the leaders of that project had to say moments after the spacecraft failed to land on the moon.
Well, we didn't make it, but we definitely tried. And I think that the achievement of getting to where we got is really tremendous. I think we can be proud.
So they managed to crash land, I guess, on the moon, which actually makes them the seventh nation to put something on the moon. Still pretty impressive. I wonder, though, had they managed to land the spacecraft, what was the goal?
Right. So, you know, this was actually kind of a proof of concept. This particular mission was started several years ago, actually in response to the Google Lunar XPRIZE challenge, which was to build, launch, and land an unmanned spacecraft on the moon and to do that as cheaply as possible. And so this Israeli group, which was actually sort of a commercial and nonprofit entity, so it was not a government entity, and that's what made this kind of a different type of mission, because all the other countries who have landed on the moon, that's all been done by the governments. And so this was different in a way.
And I have to say, for me, it was so disappointing that they got so close, and then at the last moment, something went wrong with their engine. And, you know, in the descent to the moon, because this had been months in the making, months of these intricate little maneuvers to first get into Earth orbit and then into the moon, you know, into orbit around both the Earth and the moon. And then, I mean, it just went on and on with these little intricate maneuvers. And at each step, they managed to succeed. And then at the very end, it just didn't quite come together.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think the whole story is fantastic. And I think they've done a tremendous feat. However, it is difficult to land on the moon. It is difficult. And so I think, you know, this just sort of highlights that space travel is hard and it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of input by lots of very smart people in order to achieve these great things. And we have to keep that in mind. It's not just going over to the neighbor's house next door. You know, there's a lot of things that could go wrong on the way to the moon or Mars for that matter. And so as we think about, which we should, of course, exploring the boundaries of space and human spaceflight and whatnot, we do have to keep in mind that this is very, very dangerous and it's very, very complicated.
Well, Regina Jorgensen, on that note, and especially noting that this was the Israeli attempt was a commercial attempt, right? The final event of the week, the big second big success, I guess, was that SpaceX launched their Falcon Heavy rocket. People may remember about a year ago, they launched and did a proof of concept launch and put a Tesla Roadster into space and managed to land two of their three booster rockets. This week, they put a commercial satellite into orbit and landed all three. They nailed the landings. And this is a commercial entity. Again, how important is this? I mean, I know it's important for, you know, being able to more cheaply and more regularly put some of these commercial satellites into space, but for space exploration and for space science, how important is this?
Yeah, this is very important, actually. And I do think people have been realizing this for a while, that because space travel is so complicated and so expensive, it is difficult for governments to properly fund these things, or it takes a huge amount. You know, the Apollo missions, which were now 50 years ago, NASA had a massive injection of funding from the government in order to pull those off. And so, you know, we don't have that level of government funding right now for space exploration. And so what's happened is commercial entities like SpaceX have come in, you know, with the capability to have a lot more funding to put towards these sorts of things. And so that many people really think this is the future of sort of space exploration and space travel, that if we're going to do it, it's going to be done commercially. And of course, with this recent Falcon Heavy, what's interesting, what SpaceX is trying to do is reuse the rockets. And that makes it a little bit cheaper, as opposed to just having a one-time use rocket that launches and you never get back. In this case, as you mentioned, they were actually able to land all three parts of the rocket. And so those will be able to be reused for about maybe 10 more launches or so.
Yeah, I love the difference of attitude, where it seemed like previously we thought that would just be impossible. Why even bother trying to land rockets back on Earth? It's just too hard. And in fact, you know, last year they landed 2 out of 3. They went back, they made some more changes, and this time all three landed. And it's really impressive to watch those come back down. Here's what the celebration sounded like at SpaceX.
It sounds like we landed the center core on our drone ship. We have landed the center core for the first time on our drone ship. Of course, I still love you. For the first time, we've landed all three boosters for Falcon Heavy. What an amazing day.
Well, there will certainly be more to come. And with the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moonwalk coming up this summer, I'm sure we're going to be talking more about the moon and space exploration. Regina Jorgensen is Director of Astronomy at Mariah Mitchell Association on Nantucket. Thanks so much, Regina.
Thank you.
Up next, it's been a year since a self-driving car killed a pedestrian. How much safer and more ethical is the technology now? Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's been just over a year since the first pedestrian was hit and killed by a self-driving car in Arizona. Since then, we've learned a lot about the algorithms that drive autonomous vehicles, literally. We've heard that they are safer than human drivers and that researchers are working on teaching them to make tough moral choices. But we've also learned recently that some algorithms are better at detecting light-skinned pedestrians and therefore more likely to hit a dark-skinned pedestrian. Obviously, there are still problems. So how much progress have we made in a year, and where is the development of autonomous vehicles heading? Nick Evans is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's working on the challenge of ethics in artificial intelligence. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Where are we in the deployment of autonomous vehicles? I mean, how many are on the roads right now? Are they only being tested, or are they, you know, out there and driving freely at this point?
So it depends on what we mean by an autonomous vehicle. There are certainly hundreds, if not thousands, of vehicles on the road now that have some limited measure of autonomy. So these are cars that have things like adaptive cruise control, where they can see the cars in front of them and moderate your speed so you don't run into them when you're on cruise control. As far as I know, there are not so-called fully autonomous vehicles on the road yet. These are vehicles that could start at your home and take you to work and navigate everything from back streets to busy urban environments to highways, all without you touching the wheel. They don't exist yet, but people think that they may exist within the next 5 to 10 years.
Nick, 37,000 people died in car accidents in 2016. Driving is inherently dangerous, and that's one of the motivations for trying to develop autonomous vehicles, is the idea that they could actually be safer. We've heard that they could be safer in the future, that they might be safer now. Where does that actually stand? What do the numbers tell us?
So there are two things to think about there. One is that there are a lot of deaths on the road in the United States. But the number of deaths that occur on the road in the United States are as much a function of the amount that Americans drive as it is about the danger of American roads. Now, American roads are more dangerous than roads in comparable countries such as the United Kingdom, Canada, or Australia. The other thing to think about is that those deaths are actually not distributed evenly across society. So you are more likely to die on the road if you are undereducated relative to the rest of the American population, and if you are poorer than the rest of the American population. So one of the things to think about is that although there are a lot of deaths on the road, and autonomous vehicles might solve some of them, the extra cost associated with vehicle autonomy means that the people who are most likely to die on the roads are not actually the people who are going to be saved by the autonomous vehicles.
Well, Nick Evans, flesh that out a little bit. I mean, when are they safer? What are autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence potentially better at doing? And then where do they potentially fail?
So right now, in terms of things like following and maintaining consistent and safe speeds and distances in highway traffic, it's probably true that autonomous vehicles are already safer than humans. And that's because autonomous vehicles don't get frustrated, they don't get angry, they don't tailgate people. I live in Massachusetts and this is an endemic problem. However, autonomous vehicles can very easily be spoofed or confused by relatively trivial things that almost no human would have trouble with. So you can draw 3 or 4 white marks on a road, and an autonomous vehicle, and in particular this was done on a Tesla vehicle, will view those 3 or 4 white marks as a merging lane and will suddenly change lanes. Wow. In order to match what it thinks is the rules of the road. But any human being would say, oh, that's a dinner plate on a road, or that's a plastic bag, or that's a line of chalk on a road, not an actual lane signal. So in those cases, autonomous vehicles are not only less competent than humans, but they're arguably more dangerous than humans.
As a philosopher and an ethicist, I wonder, you've raised this question, how do we even set a threshold for what is safe enough before we decide that these vehicles are something that we want to put on the road? And you've also posed an interesting question previously about whether, you know, we should set that threshold based on the total number of fatalities caused by driverless or human-driven cars, as opposed to maybe setting the threshold based on how do they react to the most vulnerable populations on the road.
So my way of thinking about this would be saying that we want to make sure that autonomous vehicles, for a broad range of cases, are better than humans and are not worse than humans in any significant way. We also need to consider these days what should be standard for cars and what should not be standard for cars when we think about safety. So right now, in every state, I believe, except New Hampshire, seatbelts are the rule and seatbelts are the law. We should start to think about which other safety features ought to be part of a car as standard rather than as optional extras.
Nick Evans, what you're describing there is kind of a hybrid system where maybe we would use autonomy or even mandate autonomy in those situations where we know that AI is better than humans at, you know, maintaining an appropriate speed, using the brakes, that sort of thing. But then there's those other situations that you were talking about where currently humans are better. And some of those come down to really tough moral dilemmas. And your work as a philosopher coming into this field, trying to inject ethics into artificial intelligence, what are some of the moral dilemmas that you've been working on?
So a lot of the concern that one will read about or listen to in the context of autonomous vehicles typically centers on deciding who lives and dies in an emergent situation. So, for example, the car has to swerve left or swerve right, and there are people who might be killed in either case, and it has to make a decision about which direction it's going to go. The current research that my team is conducting is looking at the ethics of the distribution of very small, often, amounts of risks over very large numbers of miles or long periods of time that may or may not result in fatalities at certain points, but often just increase your chances of being in a serious crash over time. So, for example, when an autonomous vehicle is passing in another lane a large truck, maybe one of the trucks that, you know, transports cars to and from lots, if it moves around in its lane in order to keep its occupants safe, is it applying risk to someone in a third lane by getting too close to that driver, or by increasing the risk that if something untoward would happen, that neither car can react appropriately in time? So these aren't necessarily risks that always involve death, But they are risks that when you add them up over the billions and even trillions of miles that Americans drive every year, could substantially affect not only the number of people who have serious injuries or die in car crashes, but also the kinds of people who can be in serious car crashes and die.
When we talk about some of these moral dilemmas, you know, it strikes me that a human being facing one of these situations where something pops up in the road in front of you, you've got to swerve one way or the other. Somebody's going to be injured or killed no matter what you do, and you've got to make a split-second decision. There's not necessarily any right decision. And I think we tend to be fairly forgiving of humans in that situation, understanding that it's difficult, if not impossible. Would we be as forgiving of an autonomous vehicle, and should we be, or is this an area where we're just not ready to go there yet?
So in terms of are we there yet, I think the answer is at this point pretty firmly no, just in terms of public perceptions. Some research by the Pew Trust shows that by and large Americans are not yet comfortable with the idea of giving over their driving to a robot. And so I think that in terms of public perceptions, there's a lot of work to be done to build the trust that is going to be needed, not only for people to get in these cars themselves, but to accept potentially the very fundamental changes to our road system that are going to be required, or will become incentivized as autonomous vehicles become more and more prevalent. If you have large numbers of autonomous vehicles on the road relative to human-driven cars, for example, it's possible to take out a lot of stop signals because the autonomous vehicles can, by and large, coordinate among themselves when one of them goes and when one of them stops. But you can imagine that people are not going to be super comfortable when we start taking out traffic lights. In terms of what should we do, I think one of the things we should do is think very hard about not only whether or not we want autonomous vehicles to replace passenger cars, but what we want our future transportation systems to look like. So right now, there are people who are very seriously saying that we should cancel or allow the New York Metro to kind of disintegrate and replace it with autonomous vehicles. That sounds promising if you're a certain kind of person, but if you're someone who relies on the metro because you can't afford to buy, insure, and maintain a vehicle, this is another moral question that autonomous vehicles raise that we haven't yet grappled with.
And it's not just access to autonomous vehicles that could perpetuate or exacerbate inequalities in our country. It appears that some of the algorithms going into autonomous vehicles are essentially racist. They are reflecting and amplifying biases that are inherent somehow in their training or the data that they were trained on. And in one particular case, they're better at seeing light-skinned pedestrians than seeing dark-skinned pedestrians, and therefore more likely to hit dark-skinned pedestrians. Do you think the field is giving enough attention? Are researchers doing enough to fix the biases that are currently inherent in artificial intelligence?
No, they are not. And the reason we know they are not is because this is not a new problem, and it's not a problem that's exclusive to autonomous vehicles. The problem with race in algorithmic bias is very long-standing. Arguably, the famous initial case that brought this to the fore was the so-called racist soap dispenser. And there are many, many other cases of this, everything from automatic doors to facial recognition in cameras and so on and so forth. These are very, very common problems with machine learning. They are serious ethical issues, and thus far, the artificial intelligence community has not done a huge amount of soul searching about making sure that we're including the right samples and the most representative samples we can when we train artificial intelligence, and also that when we test artificial intelligence, that we make sure we include the right kinds of tests to pick these issues up in testing before we deploy them into the real world.
Nick Evans, are you optimistic about this? You're still working on this technology, so I would assume you don't think it's a dead end, but how are you feeling about the prospects for this technology going forward?
I think the future is overcast. I think that there are going to be a lot of bumps along the way. I certainly don't think we're out of the woods yet, and I think that the response has been mixed by different companies. Some companies have been very open about where their technology is. They've been much more forthcoming around how they plan to deploy these kinds of technologies. I think that there's a lot of promise in autonomous vehicles, but I think that we've got a long way to go to learn the right lessons to make this a safe, accessible, and fair technology.
Nick Evans is an assistant professor of philosophy at University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's working on the challenge of ethics in artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles. Thanks so much for talking with us, Nick.
Thank you.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Air pollution kills more than 100,000 Americans each year. Specifically, a new study estimates that small particulate air pollution caused 107,000 premature deaths in 2011. But the researchers didn't stop there. For the first time, they put together data on what and where air pollution comes from, where it ends up, and where those deaths happen. The results are eye-opening. Just 10% of pollution causes nearly half of all damages, and where pollution is produced can be as important as how much is produced. Jason Hill is co-author of the study just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota and a resident fellow of the university's Institute on the Environment. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how do you estimate premature deaths due to air pollution? That's not necessarily a phrase that shows up on anyone's death certificate. It's got to be a lot of inference involved in actually figuring out how many people are killed by air pollution each year.
There is a lot of inference, and there's a lot of modeling that has to go into an estimate like that. So what we did is we developed a model that allows us to rapidly assess the impact of emitting pollution in any given location in the U.S. of any type related to this fine particulate matter, PM2.5. And using that model, we were able to infer that over 100,000 people a year die due to poor air quality from PM2.5.
How certain are you of that result, that 107,000?
Well, we are fairly certain of that. Many different studies have looked at how exposure to different levels of PM2.5 is associated with dying from cancer, heart attacks, strokes, and so forth. And so epidemiologists have worked very hard to determine that relationship. And we employ that relationship in our modeling that uses the National Emissions Inventory, emissions from all sources in the U.S. that contribute to fine particulate matter levels. And that emissions inventory is from the U.S. EPA.
You've used this term PM2.5, fine particulate air pollution. Where does that come from, and what is the specific significance of that kind of air pollution and that classification?
Sure. So there are two types of this PM2.5, this particulate matter with a diameter of less than 2.5 micrometers. The first is primary PM2.5. That's the soot you see, for instance, from fires, or from being behind a dirty city bus. So that's primary PM2.5, but there's also secondary PM2.5. And that is particulate matter that forms in the atmosphere as a result of reactions, chemical reactions, of different species, such as volatile organic compounds, sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, and ammonia.
Jason Hill, you in this study were able to drill down to what are some of the most damaging sources of pollution. And some of them are not surprising. Like you just said, you know, being behind a dirty bus or a car or a truck that's, you know, kind of spewing sooty material, it's no surprise that transportation is a major source of emissions that kill people. Also, electricity generation, you can look at a power plant and kind of see that and imagine that. But then you also say agricultural activities are a major source of emissions that cause something like 15% of deaths. What's the story there?
Well, yeah, no, that's one of the really interesting parts of this work. So you mentioned transportation. That's about 28% of all deaths. Electricity generation, about 14%. emissions of PM2.5 related species are from the energy sector, about 57% of all total impacts. But then there are emissions from other sources as well, and the major source is agriculture. Now, in agriculture, there is some of this primary PM2.5 that's released. That's largely dust from tillage. But the main source of damage from agriculture with as relates to PM2.5 is actually ammonia. Ammonia that's released from animal husbandry, essentially manure, and also from the use of nitrogen fertilizers in crop production. In fact, we had some other work that was released a week before this, in which we showed that corn production in the U.S. is responsible for about 4,300 deaths per year.
Another counterintuitive finding from this study is that it's not just the people who are living next to a power plant, or I guess right on or next to a farm, who are most at risk, but the effects can be seen more than 150 miles away. How do you explain that?
The wind. That's the simplest explanation. So 33% of damages occur within 8 kilometers of the emission sources. Sorry, we're going metric here. But 25% occur more than 256 kilometers away from the emission source.
Which my sources, meaning Google, tells me is 159 miles.
159 miles. Thank you for the precision and conversion.
So if you put all of this geographic information together, you've got a number of maps in the study in shades of yellow and red for how dangerous, essentially, it is to be in those areas. And it's basically the eastern half of the U.S. with some particularly dark red dots for some major metropolitan areas, and then major metropolitan areas in California that are really the riskiest.
Not necessarily the riskiest. The maps you're referring to in the paper are describing the damage per ton of emissions of a given type that are emitted in any given area. And emissions in highly populated areas tend to be more damaging than emissions in less densely populated areas. Often the impact of air pollution is done at a county level basis. And it assumes essentially that anywhere in a given county emitting some amount of pollution has an equal impact. What we did is we used a very fine scale grid. It goes down to 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer in urban areas. So for some areas like Los Angeles County, the damage of emitting a certain amount of pollutant can vary 56-fold. In Seattle, it's 127-fold range. So the type of modeling we did gives us much more resolution and really, I think, gets to the key of this paper. Typically, when we think about regulating emissions, we regulate based on the amount of emissions from some source. What this work allows us to do is regulate based on the damage of that emission. So, you know, ideally, you would want to focus your efforts on those sources that are the most damaging rather than focus on those sources that emit the most.
In other words, focus on air pollution being generated in cities as opposed to air pollution being generated elsewhere?
Well, not necessarily cities. You also have to take into account where that air travels. And so the corn we produce in the U.S., for instance, is not grown in cities, but it still is responsible for 4,300 deaths a year. So there are regional considerations as well in all of this.
Reading your work put me in mind of another recent study, which found that white Americans produce a disproportionate amount of air pollution and Black and Hispanic Americans bear the brunt of a disproportionate amount of that air pollution. And some of that just comes down to a minority of the population doing the majority of the consuming, and that kind of explains that disparity. But I wonder if there's also a geographic component to that. This kind of where you are affects how much pollution you're exposed to, starts to have other social ramifications as well.
It does. You're referring to some work that we published in March, and that paper focused on these environmental equity, environmental justice issues. And yes, there is absolutely a geographic component to this as well. It is within cities. It is by region of the U.S., and all that together demonstrates that there is this pollution inequity across the U.S. that affects different racial ethnic groups in different ways.
Jason Hill, these estimates of the impact of air pollution are not just academic exercises. As you've already mentioned, there's the potential to change how pollution is regulated, to focus on the damages as opposed to simply the sources. And this particular type of air pollution, PM2.5, the small particulate matter, is already really key in federal regulations. How do you see this new work potentially being used, and what kinds of changes might come out of this?
Well, the work that we present allows for regulation based on damage from any given emission source rather than on quantity of emissions. And so what regulators and policymakers will do with that, I don't know, but hopefully they'll use that information to target the sorts of interventions that they can employ to those sources of the greatest damage. And they can also do that with, say, consideration of environmental justice, environmental equity as well.
This is really the first time, the first study that has done this. Is one study enough to start changing the way that we regulate pollution?
Well, this is just the start. We are presenting in this paper a method, also a tool that people can use to assess damage of pollution from any given source. And we apply that to the U.S. National Emissions Inventory. But certainly that is just giving an idea of what the impact is, what the benefit is of changing different parts of the U.S. economy, different sectors, different emission sources, relative to the expenditure of making that change, essentially, you know, the cost of that change. And that's something that certainly needs to be looked at.
Jason Hill is associate professor at the University of Minnesota, a resident fellow of the university's Institute on the Environment, and co-author of a new study estimating the health and economic damage caused by air pollution. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, a happy environmental story, the amazing recovery of ospreys. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Since moving to Cape Cod, the return of ospreys has become one of my favorite signs of spring, right up there with the first crocuses. I can never quite shake the feeling that their mere presence is a near miracle. After all, they were vanishingly rare when I first learned about DDT as a teen, so now their recovery stands out as a welcome conservation success story. Alan Poole is an associate at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and he's spent 35 years studying ospreys. He says we've learned a lot about these birds over the past few decades. His new book is Ospreys, The Revival of a Global Raptor. Alan, thanks for joining me.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So ospreys are actually a globally distributed bird, and I'm most familiar with the story of North American ospreys, DDT, to some extent hunting, causing a decline, and then their recovery over the past few decades. What about the rest of the globe? I mean, was there a global decline, or is that really just a North American story?
There was a global decline, but not as severe in Europe as it was in the U.S., in North America. And that's partly because pesticides were not used as heavily. Ospreys there were living in remote forests where they were not as impacted by pesticides. So their population stayed more robust there, although they were knocked back. But for most of Europe, particularly England, Scotland, France, Southern Europe, Germany, Spain, and Portugal, their ospreys were basically hunted to extinction. They were seen as vermin. They were seen as birds that were competing for fish that people wanted for themselves. Backyard fish ponds. Europe was full of fish ponds.
Really?
Really. And ospreys, needless to say, are smart about finding fish. And if there's a fish pond in the backyard, they're there.
They're going to find it, yeah.
And that went on for centuries. And so it was a gradual wearing down of the populations.
And has the revival, because certainly we don't seem to have a shortage of ospreys here in New England at this point. You did name the book The Revival of a Global Raptor. So have they come back globally? And how?
They have, and that's the fascinating story, and that's what makes, for me, one of the things that makes ospreys so interesting is we're seeing these populations coming back all over the globe. But what you have, of course, are these northern birds leave in the wintertime, and they go to the southern hemisphere. So the osprey is particularly a global species when you look at its wintering sites around the world. So, for instance, ospreys in Massachusetts or Quebec or Wisconsin are going to go to South America, to the Amazon, anywhere from Peru or Colombia to Venezuela. And in Europe, an osprey from Sweden or from Scotland or from Russia would end up in Africa.
Okay, so that's kind of their general range. And we were talking about how they've declined. How did they manage to come back, whether it was from hunting or from pesticides? I mean, that's no mean feat.
It's no mean feat, and it's a fascinating story in changing human cultures, is really what it's all about. In our case, we were able to get pesticides banned, particularly the DDT, which was the critical element in the osprey's decline. In Europe, it was hunting and shooting and trapping. It's really that simple. People stop shooting ospreys.
I mean, that's pretty amazing in and of itself, because I think we hear increasingly that, you know, you can put an endangered species onto a list and stop hunting it or ban a chemical and stop exposing an animal to a chemical, but that doesn't always mean it will come back, that we might need to actually get in there and do something to help a species come back. I mean, did the ospreys come back on their own?
They came back on their own. The European story is a particularly interesting one because they recolonized a lot of areas in Northern Europe, particularly in England and Scotland, pretty much on their own. But yes, they were given a helping hand along the way. And the main way that they got a helping hand was with nest sites. Ospreys are remarkably adaptable in their choice of nest sites. Here in the U.S., here in New England, we see them nesting on phone poles, on cell towers, on buoys in harbors. They're able to find places to nest. They like high, isolated areas. And this has been one of the secrets of their success. It made a big difference here. In Europe, what's happened are people have been building nest platforms for them. We do that here as well, particularly on our salt marshes. But there, it's a question more of retrofitting trees that ospreys are trying to nest in, cutting the top out of it, maybe putting a little platform in the top of it so that it provides a safe, stable nest site. Once the ospreys have that, they're good to go. They're going to crank out young year after year after year, and that's the secret to a regenerating population.
So, Alan Poole, are the populations of ospreys at this point, if we look around the globe, pretty much back to what we would say was, I don't know, the historical, is there such a thing as a baseline or a normal population level?
There is. There is very much a baseline for North America. I mean, it's a somewhat vague baseline, but it's a pretty good one. And we know for our area here that ospreys have at least reached that baseline in most areas and gone beyond it. Here in New England, for instance, here in Massachusetts, we had in the area between New York City and Boston, which is an area that I and my colleagues have looked at particularly carefully, ospreys went from about 1,000 breeding pairs in the 1940s and 50s down to 90% decline in those, basically in the 1950s and 60s. And they are now up over 1,200 pairs in that area.
That's pretty remarkable. How much has our understanding of ospreys actually changed in the intervening years? How much have we learned about these birds?
We've learned a tremendous amount about osprey migration, and that's thanks to the new satellite tracking technology. You can put a solar-powered backpack transmitter on an osprey and have that communicate with a satellite and then back to our computers, our desktop computers, and you can follow an osprey day by day, sometimes hour by hour, in its flights from, say, Maine to the central Amazon.
I mean, you can put that backpack on this bird that is flying thousands of miles and it doesn't slow it down, weigh it down, cause it problems?
It doesn't. They seem to adjust quite well to that. And the young ones, we've learned a fantastic amount about the migration. I mean, think of this. Ospreys are doing these long-distance migrations as young birds right out of the egg on their own. They don't travel. They're not like geese. They don't travel with a family. It's every osprey for itself. And they're out there launching into the unknown, tracking their way across parts of the Atlantic, flying through Florida, down through Cuba, and then across the Caribbean from Cuba, Hispaniola. And that's a flight that's anywhere from 30 to 40 hours. So flying all night long, knowing where they're going in the dark.
How do they do that? How do they know where they're going? I mean, I have to say, I always have a little bit of like a pang of sympathy in the fall when I see the adults leave and the juveniles are still there. And it's like you said, oh, my God, they're young right. birds and they're totally on their own. Right. How do they find out where they're supposed to go?
Maybe they're saying, Mom, where are you? they're gone. The parents are gone. And the young at that point have been carefully nourished by their parents keep feeding them for at least a month after the young learn how to fly. And then you're absolutely right. They wake up one morning and their father, who is the one that actually stays on later and feeds them, is gone, and they have the capacity to migrate. It comes with the genes. It comes with them out of the egg, as is true for all of, you know, many, many other birds that are doing similar long-distance migrations. Nothing short of incredible. We think there's a very good evidence that they are using some sort of magnetic cues, using the Earth's magnetic fields to guide their trips, particularly across open water.
Alan Poole, as you look at the various threats, I mean, the book is called The Revival of a Global Raptor, and we've talked about what it's all the species has already recovered from, but you also write about all the different potential threats. Human development, as adaptable as they are, can still be a threat. Potentially climate change, plastics, all sorts of things. Are you optimistic about the future of ospreys? Are you concerned? What's the trajectory that they seem to be on right now?
Given what we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years, it's hard not to be optimistic about ospreys. And that's one of the delights of studying this bird. Here is a good news story, which we desperately need in the planetary wildlife perspective, a bird that's been able to make remarkable comebacks in many different parts of the world, partly because it can live so close together with humans. It's not easily deterred from its nest by having activity nearby. It habituates really quickly to human activity. That's the key to ospreys. If I worry about any ospreys, I worry about ospreys in parts of the world where they aren't making a recovery, and there are some. Parts of Eastern Europe, Poland, for instance, which is full of fish farms, has a very poorly regulated wildlife departments that have jurisdiction over wildlife. So ospreys continue to be shot in parts of Eastern Europe, Poland in particular. Our ospreys, ours being North America, New England in particular, are wintering in parts of South America where essentially small backyard fish farms are proliferating. Great source of protein for humans. It's totally understandable that people want to raise fish. But these fish farms are magnets for ospreys, and they're there in a flash. And you shoot one, and another one shows up. And you shoot that one, and another one shows up. We know from studies in South America that some fish farms are killing hundreds of ospreys a winter. But looked at from our perspective, this is terrible. We don't want to lose any ospreys. But looking at New England and seeing growth rates of 5 to 10% a year in our part of the world in terms of the breeding populations, I think it's fair to say that these are not having a major impact on the overall population of ospreys here in North America. We got a lot of ospreys.
And that's great news. Alan Poole has studied ospreys in New England for 35 years. His new book is Ospreys, The Revival of a Global Raptor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.